Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the Department of Defense spending and the private military intelligent industrial complex. Two panelists to share their insights. First, from Northern Virginia, will be Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is a retired U.S. Army colonel and a former chief of staff to General Colin Powell while he was Secretary of State. He is a distinguished adjunct professor of government and public policy at the College of William & Mary in Virginia. Colonel Wilkerson started as an assistant to General Powell in 1989, remained with him through his term in the Bush administration. He's been an outspoken critic of the Iraq War, the Bush and Cheney White House, including his own preparation of what became a Powell's infamous 2003 presentation to the United Nations. Recently, he has warned that what we are witnessing with the Obama administration's buildup to war with Syria is a repeat of the buildup to invade Iraq. He is a frequent commentator on television programs like The Ed Show, and he's also been featured in several important documentaries, including Why We Fight, The Israeli Lobby, and No End in Sight. He will be joined by Dr. Doug Hall from Massachusetts. Dr. Hall is the executive director of the National Priorities Project, a nonprofit organization which was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize this year and is devoted to fighting for a federal budget that works for all Americans. Earlier, he served on the project's board of directors, and prior to that, he served as a director of the Economic Analysis and Research Network at the Economic Policy Institute, where his research focused on income inequality, economic development, retirement security, labor market analysis, and the minimum wage. During his tenure, the network grew to be represented in 44 states. He holds a master's degree from McMaster's University and a PhD from Queen's University. His project's website is nationalpriorities.org. I'd like to welcome you both to the program. We're going to begin with you, Colonel Wilkerson. First, before we get into the heart of today's discussion, I'm watching the American media. In fact, I'm monitoring every major news source each day through my office. And what we're finding is, in the current conflict in the Gaza Strip, that 90-plus percent of the media reporting is slanted towards a pro-Israeli side. I'm not hearing Sean Hannity, I'm not hearing others talk about the death, the destruction to the civilian population, especially children, who are Palestinians. And in the mind of most, whatever Israel does is fine. They're only protecting their security and sovereignty. And there is no sense, in my opinion, of looking at the Palestinian cause or their plight as being anything other than what is deserved to them. Would you like to address this, please?
I've not made as studious a look at the mainstream media as you, apparently, but I have been listening to it for the last few days. And as I told my wife driving back from Walter Reed National Military Medical Center this afternoon, it's nauseous. The media that I'm listening to, the mainstream media I'm listening to, is so slanted that one gets the impression that either the Palestinians are vile and beneath human life, or they're simply not worth mentioning. I'll give you just a case in point. I was listening to NPR radio, give an accounting of the casualties, and what I heard in essence was no Israelis killed, a few injured, but none killed, and now it was 172, I think, this morning when I listened. Now it's over 200 Palestinians killed, mostly women and children and innocent civilians. And I turned to my wife and I said, now what kind of commentary is that? There is no mention of the fact that the Israeli firepower is so overwhelmingly out of proportion to anything the Palestinians could muster. Indeed, anything probably most of the Arabs could muster in general, and that they're killing wantonly, and no Israelis have even been injured. The Israeli ambassador can rail on the radio all day long about the hundreds of rockets that are landing on Israel. No one's been killed. So the disproportionate way this is being treated rivals or surpasses the disproportionate way it's been treated over the last two, maybe even three decades. The media simply don't speak for the Palestinians.
One more topic, please, before we go to the topic at hand today. And that is, you came forward to share some points of view about what we were doing in our manipulations in Syria, including what we have independently discovered now, that many of the terrorists who are alive and well in Iraq were being supported by Saudi Arabia and the United States in Jordan and in parts of Syria, and we're getting a severe blowback. But once again, if you look at the mainstream media, it was as if this was 19 or 2003 all over again, looking for weapons of mass destruction, looking for justification to intervene, and we came very close to doing that. Could you give us your perspective on lessons learned or not learned from what we went through in 2003 and now applying it to other parts of the Middle East?
Two immediate points I would make. One is the high irony of our having supported people in Syria who are now attacking our interest in Iraq, if our interests are in an integral Iraq, one that is not splintered asunder and one that is ruled essentially from Baghdad and has a central government that's tolerant, reasonably stable, and has access to and control over most of its, if not all of its territory. That's the first point. High irony there that we supported these people in Syria, and now they're attacking our interest in Iraq. The second point is this is not really, in its substance, anything more than those people whom David Petraeus some years ago awakened, as it were, in Iraq. These are the Sunnis. Now, yes, just as they had done in 2004 and 2005, they allied themselves with that element in Iraq, which had infiltrated because we'd invaded Iraq and called itself, through our terminology, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, led initially by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was such a bloodthirsty guy that even bin Laden didn't want to ally himself with him and did so only out of convenience sake. We now have a situation that's the same as it was when we were fighting it in 04, 05, and 06. That is to say, the Sunnis find the government in Baghdad so intolerant of their political interests, they've started a civil war. And as you said, Saudi Arabia is funding it, just as it funded the civil war in Syria. This is a real mess, basically one we created when we invaded in 2003, and now we sit back and wonder what to do about it.
Thank you for those insights. Now to the story at hand. I have spent the last 2 weeks with our scholars in residence, including Richard Gale, to determine on and offline budget for the Department of Defense. And taken in total, it's about $1.4 trillion.
Yes.
They don't give you that figure. They give you smaller increments. And I'm concerned about the following. All of us, any reasonable and rational person, wants to make sure that the United States is defended if attacked. That's reasonable and responsible. At the same time, I'm looking at, do we have more than enough in order to justify these expenditures? In other words, is there a point to where you're pouring water over a filled glass? And if so, why is this happening? So we did some additional research and found that in some cases, the Department of Defense's own audits found 10 separate private corporations all doing the same identical work. Redundancy was phenomenal, yet none of those contracts were canceled. We found people who were working on systems that they acknowledged in hearings were already antiquated. But because of those systems being in places where there was political power for people on important committees, they would not be canceled. But we, the American people, are paying our tax dollars on systems that will never be used, could not be used. And even so-called independents like Bernie Sanders are for the most expensive fighter jet in history, and they're hundreds of billions of dollars over budget. They're years behind, and it's still a failed system. So my opening question is that when you look carefully, as you do, at these issues, do you find that we have people who've mastered the art of reprioritizing what is important and kept us in a state of perpetual fear and anxiety, therefore justifying this budget? And if that is the case, why can't we explain this, show this for what it is, and then say, here is the appropriate amount we should spend on defense, and the rest should we reuse in infrastructure? Look at our dams. Look at our bridges. Look at the soil erosion. Look at the deforestation. Look at the droughts. Look at the consequences of not being able to have water in 21 states in severe and extreme drought. Look at our gas mains in New York State, our water mains in New York State and other places. They're antiquated, 60 to 80 years old. Why shouldn't we be using this in a more constructive way to help that which is in common to all of us? The forum is yours. Take your time.
Shall I just say amen? Your recitation was pretty complete. The defense budget is right now, it's not a mystery to me because I know how that works. I know how the bureaucracy works. I know how the Defense Department, for example, every year can't even account for, can't audit in any basic way as much money as the State Department gets in its entire budget for that year. Donald Rumsfeld once admitted to that. At that time, it was about $40 billion he couldn't put his hands on, and our budget was about, $30 billion at that time. So the bloat is humongous. The sterility is dominant. That is to say, senior leaders have their minds stuck in the past. They say big golden words like cyber warfare and full spectrum dominance and phrases like that, but they haven't a clue how to design a force, a joint force as well as the individual elements, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, Coast Guard, and so forth, to meet the challenges that we clearly see and those that we can envision for the 21st century. So that, the first problem they have is they have no strategy. Regardless of what my old friend Chuck Hagel keeps saying, and I've known him for 20 years and I like him, he's a good man, but he's bought the Kool-Aid, he's drunk the Kool-Aid, regardless of what he keeps saying, there is no strategy. That's their first problem. You cannot allocate money without a strategy. The strategy is to satisfy, essentially underneath, is to satisfy the military-industrial congressional complex, to keep Lockheed afloat, to keep Boeing afloat, to keep Raytheon afloat, and not just to keep them afloat, but to pay their CEOs 600 times what the floor workers are making and so forth. I mean, this is an intolerable situation. And when you put it against the needs that you outlined pretty well, when you put it against those needs and you see the diversion of funds, not just for the purposes of national security, because that's well surpassed by the money we spend, but for essentially these defense contractors, for the contracts that no one even knows about sometimes, as you well pointed out, for the very, very purpose of having privatized the ultimate public function, war, because that's really what we've done. We could have never kept the forces we kept in Afghanistan and Iraq without having almost double their size through private contractors, whether they were contractors who did Army and Marine Corps tasks or whether they were contractors who provided security. That's the way the military now gets around the in-strength restrictions that the Congress puts on it. It simply hires 100,000 private contractors. This might as well be the British East India Company keeping its commercial interests afloat all across the subcontinent. I mean, that's what we are today. We're an empire that's frittering away its power and its resources, not on maintaining itself, the infrastructure needs that you cited foremost of all, but on wars, on the periphery of that empire, wars that are ill-defined except for the fact that they make money for some of the oligarchy that now runs this country. It's a huge problem, and no one's going to solve the military element of it until they get a handle on this larger political element of it. There are too many people making too much money off what my old boss calls the terrorist industrial complex.
I hadn't heard that term used. We appreciate that insight.
Look at what we've done with the politics of fear. Dick Cheney manipulated the politics of fear better than anyone I've ever seen. And when you manipulate the politics of fear with two-thirds of the American people who don't have time to sit down and think about it, and you scare them badly enough, you can get them to pour out their taxpayer dollars forever. And that's essentially what Dick Cheney started. You would think that after about 12 years and still the statistical probability of our dying from a terrorist attack being roughly akin to that which goes along with lightning. In other words, we got about as much chance of being killed by a terrorist as we do a lightning strike. You would think the American people would have scratched their heads, collectively speaking, and said, well, you know, we spent $2 to $3 trillion on this so-called global conflict with these terrorists. We haven't had an attack since 9/11. Well, that's because we've done such a good job. Ah, but 9/11 cost bin Laden and Al-Qaeda probably about $500,000. We've spent $2 to $3 trillion. We're spending another trillion now. Wow. Who won, bin Laden or us?
Point well taken. One of my great concerns that the nation is no longer making our domestic affairs a priority, but rather increasing on a path of overreach in military and foreign affairs beyond Afghanistan and Iraq wars, started earlier. We're now operating on numerous fronts, although not declared wars, all these fronts and aggressive posturing against Syria, Russia, over the Ukraine, China, Libya, the developments with ISIS in the Middle East, our attempts to topple the Venezuelan government, all of these and other operations around the world add to the already $1.5 trillion spent on Afghanistan and Iraq since 2001, and also of Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winning economist at Columbia University, stated, that will multiply by increments as we take care of people who were injured and pay expenses accrued. It could go between $3 to $6 trillion. In the meantime, our national infrastructure, as I mentioned earlier, in cities and towns are in gross disrepair or collapsing. No concerted efforts are being made to prepare cities along the coastlines for the threats of climate change and rising sea levels in regions of the nation that are entering severe weather crisis. And our economy and job growth is stagnant, except for those who are in the financial sectors. And yet, any needs from the military are immediately answered. We are giving Israel $8 million every 24 hours. And that could, in the eyes of many, keep the world increasingly more unstable because there's not an honest, open process of creating peace for all the people involved. And the question on so many people's minds is why? Why are we prioritizing destabilization efforts in other parts of the world, which will eventually require further U.S. military engagement? Why are we giving greater attention to despotic regimes overseas, such as Israel, and allied ourselves with Saudi Arabia that is Sunni and Wahhabist and is exporting a lot of this terrorism and the cash for this? Why? When we should be helping the American people first. Could you please address these?
Well, you pose some excellent questions. I would direct your readers and you as well to, if you haven't seen it already or read it already, I'm on my second reading, Thomas Piketty, the French economist's book, Capital in the 21st Century, as a starting point so that you can find out such dramatic revelations as the United States has enough wealth as clearly the richest country in the world to take care of not only its security needs, even at the disproportionate amounts they're being described as now by particularly the Defense Department, and everything else, if it could only do something about its wealth. The problem is its wealth is not owned by those who would effect these changes, and primarily we're talking about government. Government writ large, whether it be city, state, province, federal government, or whatever. When you look at it, when you look at our wealth, as Piketty does, very carefully, very meticulously, you see that our wealth is roughly, in terms of public money, a balance. It's slightly negative, but it's not a plus at all. It's slightly negative. So where is the wealth, you ask yourself? And then Piketty shows you where the wealth is. The wealth is in the private sector. Well, where is it in the private sector? And you've heard about the 10% and the 1%. But But what Piketty does is show you the 1/1000th. The 1/1000th who own astronomical portions of our national wealth. When you throw that 1/1000th in with the 1/100th and then in with the 1/10th, you get the predominant amount of the wealth of this nation. And so you got 50% of this nation, that 50% that Mitt Romney, for example, so derided in his campaign privately, but it became public. That 50% is getting by on almost nothing in terms of our national wealth compared to that top 10, top 100th, and top 1,000th. So you begin to see immediately, one, why we can't do anything. We can't do anything because most of the wealth that would be aimed at the problems, the challenges you describe so well, is in the hands of these oligarchs. And two, you begin to discover that many of these oligarchs make and maintain and increase their wealth by what you just described as the exercise of empire. That is, keeping wars going, keeping fear going, keeping the military going, keeping ships sailing on the sea and planes flying in the air and F-35s going to Bernie Sanders, Vermont, which is why Bernie's not against the F-35 Lightning. And you begin to understand, I think, where the intrinsic problems are in this country today. And I might add where the huge political challenge is. Because how do you change this? Now, Piketty's solution is a global tax on wealth, essentially on capital, not earned wealth, but capital, dividends and stock returns and so forth. I think, and he says, he seems from the reading, I sent him an email, he answered me, but he seems like a very humble man. But what he shows is that you don't have this progressive tax scale nationally, or like he would like to have internationally, so much to gather revenue. You do gather some revenue. What you have it for is to destroy, or at least attenuate, this incredible disequilibrium of wealth that we have in the world, and we certainly have in this country. In fact, I think it's very clear from this work that he's done, this incredible research he's done over two centuries, with regard to France, and at least one century with regard to most European countries in the U.S., because that's what we have records for, you see clearly that we're in a period not unlike the period we were in 1927, 28, and 29. And indeed, Europe's in a period, and we're in a period not unlike France was in just prior to the Revolution. Well, we all know what that brings usually. It brings blood in the street. I would say that we need to do something about this, and some of these other challenges that you described would be far easier to meet and far easier to find the resources to meet if we did. So I think the fundamental problem in this country, the fundamental problem in the world, is this disequilibrium of wealth and the fact that it's in the hands of these people, many of whom make money off the continuation of the schemes we've described.
Thank you for that answer. While over 50% of the government's discretionary spending goes to the military and intelligence, at the same time, only 7% is targeted for transportation, infrastructure, education, science, and medical research. In 2011, the Department of Budget was greater than the next 13 countries' defense budgets, including China, Russia, United Kingdom, India, Australia, Canada, and France. In your estimation, what is the minimum military defense necessary for the U.S. to be safe? And it seems rather ludicrous to spend so much money simply to keep a physically unhealthy, impoverished, dying nation militarily safe. This is the kind of scenario we might expect from North Korea, with an overbloated military budget, but with a third-world impoverished population. Now, my background is in clinical nutrition. I have a PhD in human nutrition and public health science. I'm a research fellow at Twin Institute of Applied Biology for over 30 years in anti-aging medicine. So I focused an enormous amount of my time on seeing why in the world, with the greatest wealth in the world and more doctors per population and hospitals, more spent on health care, $3.2 trillion this year, we're ranked almost last in all the developed nations in the indices that make a difference in longevity, how healthy are you when you reach 60, infant mortality. So we're spending the big bucks and we're getting poor health care at the outcome. I'm concerned about it, yet we do not have a preventative program. So to me, I think we should be reprioritizing, at least to some degree, to prevent disease where preventable. And we're not preventing wars where they're preventable. We're not preventing incursions and surreptitious efforts and regime change where it is doable. And so we seem to have lost our way. Your thoughts?
No, I couldn't agree with you more. I've just had an experience with a young girl who's a friend of my granddaughter's. She's 12 years old. She's been diagnosed at Johns Hopkins with leukemia. And essentially, long story short, $124,000 for her first short stay in the hospital and treatments. Family looking at another $124,000 for the current treatments and hospitalization. And her answer, her mother's, the answer given to her mother by one of the people in the hospital was, well, you're going to have to declare bankruptcy, max out your credit cards, and so forth and so on, because the insurance that one of the family members has is only good enough that their copays are somewhere in the neighborhood of 20%. So they're going to be bankrupt. I mean, between them, hardworking Americans, but between them, they probably make $80,000-$90,000 a year, the two together. This is our health care system. This is our health care system. I'm sorry, lady, your daughter's dying. Go declare, if you want her to have, poor quality of life while she's getting this chemotherapy treatment, which I think is the bleeding of the 20th century, 21st century. You know, we used to bleed people. We bled George Washington before he died. Your daughter will stay alive a little bit longer, and you'll be able to talk with her and, you know, communicate with her and so forth a little bit longer. But meanwhile, we're going to bankrupt you. This is American medicine. This is horrible. This is the way we function today. And this is another aspect of the oligarchy, because a prominent part of the oligarchy are the pharmaceutical companies and the owners and CEOs thereof, and the people who, in the medical profession, I just saw a piece today about how the doctors shill for these pharmaceutical companies. Our medical system is not as good as the one I saw when I traveled to Cuba. If you want to look at a really good medical system, one that works on the promise of prevention rather than treatment, but treats, too, on a probably about the opposite ratio that we do, we spend so much money on people in the last 6 months of their lives in this country whom doctors and hospitals salivate over, that it makes it into our GDP as a major portion of the GDP. It's a staggeringly inefficient system, but it makes a lot of money for people who promote it and work in it and love it. That's a description of what's wrong in a lot of the other elements of this country that are so gorged with money that's private and can't be accessed by the public in order to make things a little bit better, whether it's infrastructure, global warming, meeting the challenges of global warming or what. Defense fits into that as another bloated structure where people make enormous amounts of money. Look at what Lockheed will make off the F-35 Lightning. Indeed, look at what Lockheed has made off the littoral combat ship. Lockheed is the largest defense contractor in the world, but something most Americans don't know, it is also the number two contractor for the Homeland Security Department. I think it's number three for Commerce. It's number two for one of the others. Most people don't know that Lockheed did the census, the last census. Think about that for a minute. A defense contractor doing the census in this country? These hands and arms and fingers are in every aspect of this country. They weave through every sinew, every tendon of our very being. They have us. They have us. And how do you ever get them loose when it's so profitable for them to be there? You cited the money that's made in this or that. Look at ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil's profits last year were so obscene they surpassed the GDP of several countries in the world. And yet ExxonMobil gets subsidies from the taxpayer. Don't ask me to explain this, because what I'll tell you is, look at the oligarchy. Look at who's making the money. Look where the money's going. What was the old adage, follow the money? Well, that's the adage that's apt to this entire discussion, whether it's defense, security, failure to meet the challenges of the future, infrastructure, whatever. Look at the oligarchy. Look at the money. Look at who's got it.
You mentioned the Navy's littoral combat ship. That has been plagued by leaks, corrosion, and engine failure. And 12 new nuclear submarines, when it's estimated by the Department of Defense they only need 8. And then you have to take a look at the Department of Defense. A study showed that they were responsible for 93% of all government fuel consumption. So if the department were a country, it would rank 34th in oil consumption ahead of Sweden. And then there are the lucrative contracts you're talking about to private corporations, often approved due to lobbyist pressuring and handouts to politicians, simply to keep jobs going in individual states, yet for unneeded weapons and hardware. You make a valid case. I want you to please hold on, because we're going to bring our other panelists on, and I appreciate your insights. My next panelist, I mentioned earlier, is Dr. Doug Hall from Massachusetts, Executive Director of the National Priorities Project. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. This has been a great conversation, and at the risk of mimicking an earlier statement, I'd just like to say, you know, ditto to everything that I've heard so far.
Well, thank you. While we hear that the budget of the United States military is around 16-20%, there's also the huge amount of federal discretionary spending of approximately 55%, which goes more often than not to the military. So I'd like you to begin by giving us a clear picture of the size of money that directly and indirectly is funneled into the military-industrial complex. And please compare that with percentages of other spending for domestic needs that American citizens in towns and cities are in desperate need of today. And in your estimation, how is Obama compared to previous presidential administrations
with respect to this? Well, there's no question that the phenomenon that you're speaking of is very real, and it's truly striking. I mean, you know, your other guest has been living in this world for decades and knows the insides and out of it. And I'm relatively coming new to this this world of looking specifically at the military. My background is sort of more in the, you know, in that guns versus butter trade-off. I've been spending most of my career on the butter side of that equation. And, you know, when you look at the pie chart in front of me here of discretionary spending, and as you say, you know, over 50%, 55% of that, $640 billion in 2015, is going to military purposes. And that's before you start adding in, you know, some other pieces of the puzzle that you certainly could add in, like, you know, apportioning out some share of the public debt, for example. If you contrast that with, you know, education, where we're spending $71.5 billion, you know, just a little over 10% of that amount. I mean, you know, how we spend our money is a reflection, or should be a reflection, of what our priorities are. As you mentioned, my organization is the National Priorities Project, and we want to move so that our federal budget is, in fact, a reflection of the priorities that we share as a people, that we share as a nation. And so what we're saying to ourselves and to the world is, we don't really value education. We much prefer put our money behind warfare and to line the pockets of those very oligarchs that we've been hearing about over the last half hour. And you know, I was sitting here quietly applauding at every reference to, you know, whether it was referring to Thomas Piketty's work or the failure to invest adequately in infrastructure. I mean, those are the issues, those are the concerns that really should be not just taking up our attention, but also on which we should be focusing our collective public resources. And clearly that has not been the pattern, and we need to do a great deal of work to, you know, reverse some of those trends.
Would you comment on President Obama's current proposed budget for 2015?
Well, you know, obviously, you know, it's not the budget that I would like to see. You know, if I was imagining sort of a path from where we are today to where I'd like to be 10 years down the road, you know, I would obviously want to see some significant, you know, scale back in that military budget. Instead, what we see is, you know, whether it's through the sequestration process, you know, or the Affordable, the Budget Control Act, for example, the military, in fact, has been very ingenious about, you know, literally creating slush funds that they can sort of move off that budget so they can keep spending money hand over fist, continue to be lining the pockets of those high-end military contractors that we've been hearing about, whether it's Lockheed or others, and at the expense of the very needs of the people that really should be the focus of our national spending.
According to your National Priorities Project's calculation, the government will have spent all total $9 trillion since 9/11 on national security programs. What are the major programs contributing to this cost? And in your research, how much of this is likely going to private corporations like Halliburton or Arup and other major firms in the military complex? And then follow that, please, by how does the private military complex manage to, in effect, get in line, be first always with cash going to them, and with every expense simply being a cost of doing business, including their private jets, their corporate headquarters, their massive insurance, liability insurance, all that we pay for, then they get a profit on top of that. If you could deal with that, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, and, you know, again, I think Colonel Wilkerson's sort of set the stage for us here by referencing what he's calling the military-industrial congressional complex. And, you know, what it really does come down to in the final instance is the fact that those folks, you know, they're the folks who have power, they're the folks who have money, they're the folks who have huge armies of lobbyists with, you know, congressional staff and Congress people themselves on their speed dials, whether it's on their iPhone or their BlackBerry, or maybe they're going old school with their Rolodex. And they're the ones who get access to those channels of power. And when push comes to shove, those are the voices that are being listened to. You know, you contrast that, for example, with a great organization like our colleagues, the Coalition for Human Needs, an organization that speaks on behalf of the whole broad, complex field of public policies that directly address the well-being of people, whether it's anti-poverty programs or you know, food assistance programs or the earned income tax credit. And they've got a staff of, you know, five or six or something like that. You know, whereas the larger lobbying firms would have staffs of that size that correspond to every single congressional representative. And, you know, that's just a pretty clear illustration of the ways in which the deck is very much stacked against the people. You know, it's a classic example of putting profits before people and, you know, more specifically, putting the profits of very well-heeled private sector corporations ahead of those needs of the people of the United States.
There have been seven major studies done by independent organizations determining is the privatization of a chore service better than if the government were to do it itself. And without exception, it is not a savings to the taxpayer, nor is it better service. But once they become insinuated within the establishment, it's like a metastasized cancer. It just keeps growing until they become excessively bloated. And then they have to spend the money that they got from the last year in order to justify an expanded budget this year. And yet no one is stopping and saying, how many of these contracts do we actually need and what should be a reasonable way of holding them accountable? Because in the real world that you hear so many people talk about, oh, you know, if you run a business and you're not running it right, then in our system, that business should not succeed. But these people fail in spite of themselves, and yet we continue to bail them out, even when they're found engaging in fraud like Halliburton. When they have to pay fines, they're given another contract. They're given, Blackwater was given $1 billion since it was exposed they killed those people in that square, and it's being litigated now. Why is this happening? Give us your insights on this, please.
Yeah, and to me, the real striking irony here, of course, is that we hear all these horror stories and sort of the accepted mythology of waste, fraud, and abuse in government. And what you and I know, and Colonel Wilkerson knows all too well, is that the waste, fraud, and abuse that's going on out there is happening in the private sector side. It's still eating up public sector money, but it's certainly not, you know, child welfare, you know, social workers who are the ones who are, you know, frittering away our public dollars by any stretch of the imagination. You know, you talk about the need for accountability in the system, and you know, what it comes down to, unfortunately, is that these same oligarchic powers that we're speaking of that have stacked the deck, you know, against the public good, against smart national priority making, those same people, those same dollars are being fueled into making sure that the political process itself is skewed and not as responsive to the public as it should be. You know, if we were following, you know, if we were governing by public opinion, and I don't think that's necessarily a good idea, but we certainly wouldn't be spending our money the way that we have been. But people have, I think, become jaded. They become cynical because, you know, the path for them to try to influence their congressional representatives to shape public policy, it's a long road, and it's very difficult for people to see that there's anything that they can do that will, in fact, make a difference down the road. And unfortunately, we don't have enough, you know, outspoken, congressional representatives, people like Senator Sanders, people like Senator Warren, who are willing to sort of, you know, thumb their noses at the power structures and say, listen, this is not, in fact, how it should be. And you know, certainly your comments about the F-35 suggest that even that perhaps hasn't gone as far as it should have.
There are a lot of corporations using slush funds. There are government agencies using slush funds. In fact, recently in New York City, we were found to have tens of millions of dollars by the city council that was just a slush fund for political contributions. And we're aghast at this because this isn't the way it's supposed to work. Could you give us your insights on how the slush funds work for military spending and how lucrative have these funds been for private military contractors?
Well, certainly we're talking about, you know, tens of millions of dollars, and there's no question that these funds exist in such a way that, you know, they're sort of intentionally off budget. And, of course, one of the ironies, I think, of the entire budgeting process where, you know, in the Defense Department side is that, you know, you can hide an awful lot of stuff in the midst of $648, $650 billion. You know, so where we might have Congress spending weeks discussing how to allocate, you know, $50 million to further extend unemployment insurance, that same $50 million, you know, gets lost in the shuffle in terms of discussions around the Defense Department. It's almost, you know, it's not quite a rounding error, but it's pretty small. And, you know, you end up having these massive spending packages where folks are, you know, literally doing a shell game, moving money from this pot to another pot. And, you know, even folks whose full-time careers involve tracking those military expenditures, you know, it can be intimidating for them. And so for the, you know, for mere mortals, for regular, you know, citizens who have, you know, kids to raise and medical appointments to keep and jobs to work, they don't stand a chance of being able to, you know, in any meaningful way, keep track of what's going on with those expenditures. And so it falls to, you know, to folks like you and I to try to explain to them in ways that they can wrap their head around. But at the end of the day, it's a super heavy lift. And you know, we do the best we can, but we'd like to do much better, you know?
Some institutions, such as the Project for on Government Oversight, have identified areas where budgets could easily be slashed and not threaten the national security at all, such as funding for military personnel on over 900 locations overseas, including 40,000 troops alone in Europe. They're certainly not needed. Would you address this, please?
Well, certainly. I mean, and one of the things that I think the folks whose job it is to sell defense spending to the rest of us, they're very good at is creating this sort of false equivalence between, you know, whether we quote-unquote support the military, you know, support our men and women, and, you know, on behalf of the folks who are risking their lives around the world on our behalf, you know, and that's not what this is about. You know, I almost wish it was, because unfortunately we see, for example, with something like the VA hospital problems, that, you know, we haven't necessarily put the well-being of our men and women in the military at the forefront of our decisions as they maybe should be. But there's no doubt that we can and should be scaling back some of those operations. There's no need for the United States to have
you know, troops on the ground and the number of nations that it does, you know, especially in a world where, you know, we have technology that can help us, you know, as an alternative to those troops on the ground. And frankly also, you know, I think it'd very much behoove us to invest a little bit more perhaps in actual diplomacy and a little bit less in militarization. You know, certainly when you see something like, you know, the attention that we're seeing focused falsely, of course, on the incident at Benghazi, you recognize that, you know, when you start cutting back on you know, the core support for diplomatic entities, you know, throughout the world, that's going to have consequences, and we, in fact, should be increasing our investment in those sorts of endeavors as an alternative to spending our money on military might and weapons control systems and you know, systems that are either redundant or have huge shortcomings in terms of their proven capabilities. You know, the old adage of throwing good money after bad, I'm afraid, is all too much sort of the norm in defense contracting, it seems.
Last night on 60 Minutes, there was a segment featuring the look inside of some nuclear strike missile bases out in Iowa. And there was only one brief mention that these are necessary as a deterrent. And I can tell you, as someone who has opposed nuclear proliferation throughout my career, and I did a multi-award-winning documentary called Knocking on the Devil's Door, A Deadly Nuclear Legacy, that we're spending over $7 billion a year. That's with a B, just to maintain our existing stockpiles. We could reduce those down tremendously, but there's a whole industry of support systems, private contractors, that get billions of dollars to maintain it and even to create new types of improved systems. There's nothing improved about it. And yet we do not talk about where we're spending the money. We don't challenge how we're spending it. Let me give you an actual story. I've been on WPFW radio in Washington, D.C., one of our sister stations, for 31 years. 5 days a week. I did a lecture there last year at the Civic Center, and it was packed. And a gentleman came up to me, and he said, I'm one of the people in your audience that works within the system here. And when I hear you being critical of how these bloated bureaucracies actually function, I just smile because we're aware of it. Let me tell you a story. And he said, I can't tell you who I am, and I won't tell you where I work, but I can promise you what I'm telling you is true. He said, it is very common not to put anything in emails, not to have any phone conversations directly with a person because you're creating a trail. Instead, it's the early morning racquetball tennis matches, and then the conversations and breakfast later, and here's how one went, he said. That a very important lobbying firm had one of its senior lobbyists talk with someone in the military about why they should be allowing certain bids to go through because of what it would mean for that person later in life when they exited the military. And they gave examples of admirals, generals, colonels, all forms of people who were significant when they were in the procurement side or in the expert side, testifying before congressional hearings as experts. And he said, that's who is of value. And then gave some discussions about what would the reward be. Well, in the job the person had, let's say they were making $110,000, $20,000 a year with health care, here you're going to make $700,000 start. You're going to get a American Express card. You can run up any expenses you want. You're going to have a leased automobile of your choice. You'll have use of the corporate jet throughout the year. You'll have your apartment for the first year paid for in Washington, D.C., and that is just where we begin you at. Now, then we look at how many lobbyists there are, how many people are not registered as lobbyists, but rather are consultants where you don't have to register. And he said, everyone is involved. He said, legislative aides, the chief of staff of different legislators, these are the people who are going to work there for 5 or 10 years and then move right into the pharmaceutical industry, the energy cartel industry, the banking industry. And he said it's a revolving door. He said, look where the head of the FDA, the U.S. Public Health Service, look where the head of the CDC, look where they go to work when they're retired from government office into the very industries they were supposed to be regulating. He said, and this is going on every day, and this is why the people are never in the loop. They're excluded. They don't know how these contracts come about. They don't know how a company, start a company, suddenly has, you know, 15 former top stars in Washington, D.C., on its consulting or board of directors. He said, and this is all over Washington, D.C. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, certainly that's a really stunning and horrific example of what I think many of us sort of know, you know, inherently to be true, but to hear it spelled out in such specific details is pretty troubling for sure. And, you know, to me, you know, I think we've identified some of the really key core issues here. You know, that the revolving door of which you speak is clearly a huge problem. You know, the rise of the oligarchy and inequality is certainly another. You know, the sort of more general, you know, military industrial congressional complex, of which probably both are examples or contribute to. You know, some of those things, those are the really core issues, and we don't have a lot of really good mechanisms to help address those. And the ones that we do have, those very same powers, are focusing as much of their attention as they need to make sure that, the pendulum doesn't sway very far back in the direction of the people. You know, certainly to hear, those sorts of explicit, you know, agreements being made where the interests of and the well-being of the people and are not being addressed, are not even on the table for discussion, in fact, is really horrifying. And you know, even just to look, for example, at our complete failure to meaningfully address climate change, when it's very clear that even those people who maybe don't agree with it, it's clearly in their interest that we, in fact, do take measures to make sure that we can still breathe the air, you know, 10, 20, 30 years down the road. And the forces of this oligarchy have, you know, ganged up against the rest of us and made sure that our voices are being silenced. And it's troubling, to say the least.
Well, I think we should take all money out of politics, 100%. I believe we should ban all private corporate lobbying. And I believe that we should, at the same time, start electing people who are truly independent and who care about the people and not just handpick people who come from a selected pool of the corporate Democrats or corporate Republicans. We've taken a look to see what they have represented. And it doesn't matter whether one is screaming at the other. It ends up benefiting the people who control both. And then we take a look at the foundations, the think tanks, the people behind the scenes that represent the credibility issue, that give the pedigree and the veneer of authenticity to these people's weak and feeble arguments. And there are hundreds of those, from the Free Enterprise Institute and the others. And then we look at the media that is now in the hands of five major corporations, the vast majority of the media, and they're not fair and balanced. They're extremely subjective. You look at the people they bring on from their get list of get guests. They're all on Fox. They're all neocons. They're all people who have a vested interest associated with some foundation. Someone's paying them, and they give their opinions. But these are not objective, independent opinions. So I think the average American had best wake up to how imbalanced our conversations are in this country at the national level. Final comment, please.
Well, certainly those are all important and well-taken points. You know, my concern, I have several. One, I think, is that as much and all as we have clearly demonstrated that there's a great deal wrong with government, including certainly on the military side, there's also a lot that we need government to continue to do to, you know, ensure the well-being of folks who are out there who obviously don't have the kind of power that we're talking about. You know, the way in which a program like SNAP, for example, food stamps, you know, help people through the worst parts of the recession, you know, that was huge and really very wonderful. And we need to make sure that in our fervor to reform the system that we are very careful to make sure that we don't throw out any of the babies with the dirty parts of the bathwater.
I fully agree with that. Dr. Doug Howell, thank you very much for being with us and all the good work that the National Priorities Project is doing. You certainly deserve being nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize this year.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate having me on the show, too.
And that is also the website, and also Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Thank you for having the courage after a stellar career in the military to stand up to those who have defiled their allegiance to this country and its citizens for profit and gain. We commend you for that. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother,
like,
stop.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.